On this edition of The Literary Life, my guest is Peter Balakian, and together we celebrate the publication of his new collection of poems, No Sign. Carolyn Forché says that No Sign possesses an historical depth I have found nowhere else in American poetry in recent years. What Balakian has achieved here is a brilliant assimilation of the historical, philosophical, political, and psychological. Peter is the author of another 7 books of poems, including Ozone Journal, which won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize. In addition to his poetry, Peter has written the best-selling The Burning Tigress and his memoir Black Dog of Fate, both books exploring his Armenian roots. Our wide-ranging conversation explores all of this and also his very important work with Writers for Democratic Action. Peter Balakian, welcome to The Literary Life.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Rich, with you at Books and Books in Miami on the first day of May. What could be better?
Nothing can be better. And what even was even better than it all, than all of that, was a couple of nights ago you were with us here at Books and Books and you gave a remarkable reading from your new book, No Sign. And you had in the audience people from, it seemed like, every aspect of your life. You had the Armenian community there. You had a poetry community there. It was really quite beautiful, actually.
Thank you. It was it was a memorable night for me. And when students show up whom you taught decades ago, you're always feeling nice.
Yeah, you know, it's so cool because one of Peter's high school students came. How did that make you feel?
Very old.
That is true. That's what happens. But she loved seeing you at that time. But what I also want to know is, you're experiencing Miami. You've been to Miami before, but how are you finding Miami on this trip?
Miami is really a new zone for me. I have been here once or twice before, but I have spent a couple days just observing the scene along Ocean Avenue, and I find it a singular American sight. I've never seen anything like that particular zone, where you have this gorgeous beach and water, and then you have a couple hundred yards of park with these, and again, to a northerner's eye, the sensuality and lushness of Florida is mythic. And here it is, palm trees and green and flowers of the semi-tropic world. And you have 50 feet from that, you have this promenade, you know, this pedestrian street. And I've never seen more fashion, more people from all colors and all ethnic groups. So the true best of American culture, really the melting pot, promenading down this great boulevard with all the hotels and restaurants and bars. The whole thing in a 200 or 300 yard, you know, stretch is a kind of slice of American life of a kind I simply haven't seen anywhere else.
And you're staying at the Betsy Hotel, which has a writer's room.
Yeah, the Betsy's really terrific. It like your bookstore, the Betsy is a piece of serious American culture. It's a hotel devoted to the arts, literature. Jazz is playing around the clock, practically. At least you go to sleep listening to jazz, and you wake up listening to jazz. The Plutzik family has done something marvelous with the Betsy, so it's an honor to be there. And from there to your bookstore here in Coral Gables is like a perfect slide from one piece of culture to another.
Speaking of that slide, what I loved about our reading was when Jonathan Plutzik, in his introduction of you, talked about his father, Chaim, And you have a relationship with Chaim as well. You knew of his work. And you both sort of riffed, and you mostly, on something that I found fascinating as a lover of the history of poetry, of that part of New York that meant and means so much to the history of poetry. Speak to that a little
bit. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been teaching at Colgate University for 42 years. When I arrived in 1980, my colleague, dear friend, no longer living, poet and translator Bruce Berlind was excited to introduce me to upstate poetry culture. And it was a circuit. It was called the Upstate Circuit. And it had been really kind of a dynamic reading tour would go through upstate New York in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And the poets of upstate New York kind of made a whole culture of their own. And if you start in the West at University at Buffalo, SUNY Buffalo, you have Robert Creeley. And if you go to Rochester, another 150 miles down the road, you had Chaim Plutzik, who was later succeeded by Anthony Hecht. And you come down another 100 miles or so, and you're at Syracuse University, where you had Delmore Schwartz, W.D. Snodgrass, Philip Booth. Later, you'd have Raymond Carver and Tess Gallagher. And then Hayden Carruth. You come down the road to Colgate, where my colleague Bruce Berlind was. I would join him by 1980. And then a little bit down the road to the east was Allen Ginsberg's Poetry Commune Farm. And you kept going, you know, east to Albany and so forth, down to Binghamton. And there were poets everywhere. And they were really poets who were defining the art during that mid-century period. So it was really a wonderful synergy to find myself here with you and Jonathan Plutzik making the events possible, and then talking to Jonathan about his father. His father was a wonderful poet, died too young, but he's left behind some really fine books.
But you talked about, I happen to know that you're from New Jersey originally, right?
I am.
And so talk about when poetry became, in your mind, an option for you to be able to live your life as a poet and someone who could see no other life other than being a poet.
Well, things happen in phases always for us. And I, as a high school kid, I was immersed in playing varsity football and basketball and baseball. I really worshipped at the altar of those sports, and played seriously and hard and all that, and went off to college to play for a year as well. But underneath, I had become obsessed with language. I had become obsessed with lyric language. I didn't call it lyric language then. It was just poems and songs. Bob Dylan was a big impact on me because he brought dense lyric language into the domain of rock, folk, rock, popular music, all of it. And, you know, it's looking back at it, it's a kind of weird, atypical story. People like Bob Dylan don't go into popular music. They go to MFA programs. But Dylan was that strange hybrid, and his songs matter to me. I fell in love with the poems of Hart Crane, Emily Dickinson, Whitman, at the middle of high school. And so something started happening in me that was not going away. And when I got to college, I did a kind of about face. I left my jock life. I left the football team. I wasn't interested in taking orders from the coach anymore. And it was a very intense and turbulent time. I entered college. I entered Bucknell University in the fall of 1969. And the anti-war movement was a defining reality, especially for us 18-year-old boys who had just received draft cards. and it got you engaged in civic life. The war was wrong. The war was criminal, and now you are being asked to participate in it, and you had to start thinking for yourself about who you were and how you wanted to be. Now, I didn't start writing poems about the war or against the war. Those two things were happening kind of simultaneously in slightly different alleyways for me as a college student. But both of those zones, the writing of poems and the getting immersed in the kind of politics of American culture, liberated me into a new space for me, you know, like it did for many college kids. But the writing of poems became a habit and an obsession, bad as my college poems no doubt were. I had a marvelous teacher and mentor, poet and fiction writer Jack Wheatcroft, no longer living, but a dear lifetime friend. And working with him, finding a teacher in college who would take you seriously is one of the great good fortunes of life, of anyone's life. And I wish all students that kind of good luck when they go to college. But for a short period in the 1970s, I was friendly with Richard Hugo. And Dick Hugo was a marvelous, and I love his work. I love his iambic tetrameter, moving to pentameter, blank verse, and those poems about lonely and desolate Midwest and Western towns. And for a while I had some rapport with Hugo, and that was important to me. But really, my poet mentors in person were not that many. They were mostly in the form of the books I was reading that were having impacts on me.
You didn't necessarily follow the path of many writers. You didn't get an MFA. Instead, you got a PhD in literature.
I didn't go to graduate school to do the MFA route. I did a PhD in American Studies at Brown, mid-70s to 1980, but the end of the 70s I was at Brown. And I studied with some amazing scholars of American literature, Hyatt Wagner and Dave Hirsch in particular. And I became good friends with Michael Harper, who was the poet at Brown I most gravitated to. And we had a lovely friendship and a kind of good conversation. Michael was a very interesting figure.
But you also had this political sensibility that had been developed and forged through the 60s and 1969 particularly. And these, they sort of all kind of came together as well because of your unique familial and personal background as well. And I happen to know only because at the reading, as I mentioned earlier, there was an incredible Armenian contingent that came. And you've written a number of books about your Armenian heritage, about the Armenian Holocaust. So speak to that for a little bit, if you will.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Mitch, at a certain point in your life as a writer, I'm a young poet in the middle of the 1970s, really in my mid-20s, and just writing poems. This is what you do. You write and write, and you stumble, and perhaps it's more than stumble, because I think it's probably... there's a sense of inevitability about the things you discover. I came to discover the traumatic and bloody history of my family's survivor stories of the Armenian Genocide of 1915 that was carried out by the Ottoman Turkish government behind the chaos of the screen of World War I. During which time about 1.5 million Armenians were slaughtered, another 1 million+ deported brutally, so that in the end, by the end of World War I, an ancient civilization, a 2,500-year-old civilization, had been wiped out on its historic land. And in fact, before it was all over, the three major Christian minority cultures of the Ottoman Empire had all been just about exterminated, the Greek and Assyrian communities as well, following off the Armenian massacres. Well, this history wasn't spoken about in my household very much. This was kept under wraps. This was really a repressed history. And my closest grandparent, my maternal grandmother, who's been like the great soul guider of my life, was a death march survivor. She lost everyone in her family except her two infant toddler daughters. A prosperous silk merchant and textile merchant family from Diyarbakir, southeast Ottoman Empire, historic Armenia, today Turkey. Her story leaked out in small little tidbits that would whirl around in my head as a kid. I didn't know what to make of any of these tidbits. Clearly, I stored them up. And when I was old enough to begin thinking about life and meaning and history and culture and family, these filaments of trauma started leaking back into my imagination and started to affect my language and my poems. I began writing poems in which my grandmother was starting to figure as a kind of persona, a voice, a revenant. And so a couple of these poems appeared in my first book, a 1979 book called Father Fisheye. And then in 1983, I just spilled into a book-length cycle of poems that made up my second book, Sad Days of Light. So the Armenian genocide legacy, the transmission of trauma across generations, as it came to be called, I didn't have that phrase in my head in my 20s or even 30s, but that idea, that transmission of trauma across generations came to inform a piece of what I was doing as a poet. But yeah, Black Dog of Fate was my first prose.
And then The Burning Tigress as well.
And The Burning Tigress, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response was my narrative history about the events of the Armenian Genocide and how they engaged American culture and American relief and rescue movements in the 19-teens, which is an extraordinary American story.
And I know, just because I know you, that what's happening in Ukraine resonates in a different way for you as well with this background that you have.
Yeah, it's very, it's triggering and shocking to watch the destruction of Ukraine day in and day out since late February. And there are many things it triggers and many things it inaugurates, the Putin's monstrous and criminal invasion of Ukraine. But one of the bells that rings for me as a student of history is the profound significance of lying and denialism. And I want to say this in the context of the Turkish government's 107-year-old campaign of lying about the Armenian genocide, of international denialism and coercion about that history, because the denial of genocide, for example, I mean, you can deny many kinds of crimes, but denial of genocide, scholars like to remind the world, is the final stage of genocide because it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators. Now, what we see Putin doing day in and day out is lying about his entire campaign of criminal behavior in Ukraine, lying to his own people, and denying the very historical reality of Ukrainian identity, Ukrainian history, Ukrainian language and culture. Our good friend Oskold Melnichuk has written a lot about this in recent months. And Putin's level of denialism, again, reminds us that lying and denying reality and history is a component of human rights criminality.
And I'm specifically going to ask you, I'm going to change the trajectory of our conversation. I love the love poem that you read at the end of the reading the other night.
I can write about love, war, art, God, nature. And as we are here on May 1, this poem happens to be titled, How Much I Love You. How much I love you because your shadow walks through the wall, because my heart is a double beat, because throbbing moves around the room the way floaters spin across the eye, because the pale green of wet leaves, because the confusion of new grass, because the brush strokes are blue, because buds of azaleas spread across lawns, because daylight is water.
So beautiful, Peter. Thank you for that. That's from Peter's new book, No Sign. And it's a beautiful book. Peter, the image on the cover, where is the image from? I know it's, it's an Ellsworth Kelly.
Yeah, it's an image.
It's a beautiful painting.
It's a clean, minimalist, abstract form from Ellsworth Kelly. And I hope those who buy the book will enjoy playing with the relationship between the image and the title of the book. And maybe it'll take them into the book with some complexities that I hope reverberate through the poems.
Yeah, and I know you have an abiding interest in art as well, as I know.
Yeah.
And that probably stems from just a lifelong interest in things in general, right?
I really, you know, I painted a little bit in college and I didn't pursue it. But I'd like to do some visual art in coming years. I studied art seriously, almost had a double major in art history. So I've been immersed in the visual arts my whole life. I like many poets, I would put myself into the ekphrastic zone. I write a lot about art.
Well, and I think the only way I got him here to do this podcast on a Sunday was that he wanted to come and spend some time in our art room that we have filled with art.
Oh, Mitch, it's the greatest so, art room I've ever seen.
Well, it was a big lure to get him over here.
It wasn't. I would have hitchhiked here from South Beach, but your art room, which I'm going to spend time in as soon as we're done with the podcast, is the most extraordinary room of art books I've ever seen, period.
Well, it's lovely to have it for
you. So
you
clearly are
to be there.
Art.
I would love you to read another poem, if you would, too. Would you read the poem that you wrote that is about Vietnam?
We all got draft cards back then, before Nixon did away with the draft and turned it into a professional army. But after, and there was a transitional moment when the protest against the war was becoming so great in all walks of American life, and the Nixon administration decided to institute a lottery, meaning that your birthday was drawn out of a hat, and that positioned you in order to how likely it would be for you to be drafted. And so we were in that moment, you know, we were waiting. At first you were waiting for your draft card, and then later you were waiting to see where your birth date would put you. It was a time fraught with anxiety and fear, as well as a moral revulsion about the war being a deeply misguided mistake, as Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers later made clear. This poem is set in high school days. I'm a college football, high school football player at that time, a running back, and our team turned out to be an undefeated one. It was a fun year and one level, but underneath all that, there was darkness lurking, waiting for a number. Words appeared as the soft purring of a cat, crow screeching, end of a hymn, cicadas in trees spilling in the white noise of my head. Da Nang, Mekong, Saigon, Nam. I walked suburban streets to school, hi-fi blasting somebody to love, coach meeting out orders, my playbook of fakes and jives, my head swelling in the helmet. Over sweet cocktails with my beloved. Under the yellowing ginkgos of 64th off Lex, for a moment I felt grown up. And then the air in my head was orange, chemical Dow and DuPont, the jukebox blasting light my fire. And where were we? Staring at the image, pistol to the head, a boy I once knew on the white-lined field was bagged and flown back in the dioxin haze of morning. In the mangrove of my head, chopping sounds. Under the covers, rice paddies, floating mirrors with unidentified objects. There were Catholics in Saigon and Catholics on my street. What about Laos? What about Cambodia? American questions spilling in sunlight on white shutters. And I'm home on plush carpet waiting for a number.
Peter, that's a remarkable poem. And it brings back, even though I'm just a couple years younger than you, I remember that because I got a lottery number as well. Even at that, by that point, we sort of knew that, you know, nobody from my age would be going at that point. But there was still that fear and that sense of expectation. And, you know, you describe it so perfectly and beautifully there. And also just the kind of confusion that you must have felt.
For me, and I'm sure for many, it was a time of reckoning and rethinking values and priorities. Perhaps an image in my head, that in my life, that helps crystallize it. One weekend in late August of 1969, I was at Woodstock. And the next weekend, I was weighing into the freshman football locker room at Bucknell. And these two worlds were starting to collide for me. They weren't quite making sense. And I figured it out, you know.
Well, you took the road that was the right road for you to be taking, which we can now talk about something where we first met, which, you know, the echoes of what you've just been talking about reverberate in what the group that brought us together.
Right.
Which is a group called Writers for Democratic Action. And why don't you talk a little bit about how that group started? I was a little late to coming to the group, but it has a really interesting kind of genesis.
Well, Mitch, you didn't come that late, but your presence has been extraordinary because you know, your ability to connect writers to the nation through bookstores is an extraordinary thing. So I know how grateful I am to you and the whole group is. It's been an exciting group, even though we've known each other mostly on Zoom, because our experience has coincided with the pandemic. The origin of the group came out of another group that I'm a part of, Robert J. Lifton's Wellfleet Seminar. Robert Lifton, I'm sure many of our listeners know, is the eminent psychiatrist and historian who's written so many extraordinary books about mass violence and trauma and survivor experience. Well, I had just come from a Robert Lifton Wellfleet meeting, and Todd Gitlin, the great 60s student activist and leader and writer and journalist. And
we just lost Todd.
We just lost Todd this year. And he was, as again, many know, the chair of the Graduate Journalism School of Columbia. Well, Todd, after our meeting, called me up and said, "Hey, Peter, why don't we just get together with a few writers and see if we can do something to help the Biden campaign?" And this was around August 1 of 2020. I don't think Kamala Harris was on the ticket yet. That was about to happen. And I said, "Yeah, Todd, I mean, we both agreed this is a scary time. 2020 election is like none other we've known. So much at stake and on the line." So we got together a group of writers, and we were 8 or 10 at the start, and we grew to another 15 maybe for our steering committee, and by mid fall we were off on a real journey. Our first incarnation was Writers Against Trump, and our next incarnation in January of 2021 was Writers for Democratic Action.
Here, yeah, and I got involved with when the group was mounting these wonderful Zoom meetings with in various states, swing states, to try to energize voters in those states. We did one in Florida. Right. One was done in Georgia. One was done in Texas. Really, really interesting. And a lot of the writers in the group, people like Carolyn Forché and Siri Husfed and Paul Auster and others who...
Yeah, Jim Carroll, Oskold Melnichuk, Jill McCorkle, and there's a whole group.
It's an amazing group of people.
It's a gorgeous group of people with profound commitments both to literary culture and the making of the art we make, and also the responsibility writers can take on for the larger civic whole.
What is the biggest fear you have lurking in the politics of today?
You know, Mitch, I think we're really hitting a ground zero moment where the very foundations of democracy are at stake. I mean, we are witnessing unimaginable assaults on the foundations of our culture. And we've seen what movement conservative and Republican Party have done with voter suppression and voter restriction in so many states as an act of bitterness and anger for the excellent democratic process of the fall of 2020. We see the corrosive impact of Donald Trump's big lie. I mean, it's a big lie that's up there with now a lot of the big lies of the modern era, trying to claim that the 2020 election was stolen, when indeed it was the fairest and most well-vetted election in recorded American history. And the Supreme Court testified to that, as did Trump's own attorney general. So we have fallen into hazardous times. We now see assaults on books, the public school curriculum,
The press
has been under fire since the beginning of the Trump regime. And also the very fundamental bureaus of American government.
With the election, with the defeat of Trump at the ballot box, I know that I had thought that perhaps a lot of that kind of denialism that was going on would fade away. But instead, there have been new voices trying to pick up on it and trying to sort of extend the lie. And it's become really, really cynical. We're seeing that in our own state with our governor. I think that is something that is more dangerous even than Trumpism in a sense. Boy, that's these are the reasons why I love being on that Sunday call, Peter, to be able to hear, you know, with the eloquence that you possess, you know, crystallizing where we are right now. But you know what I want to do too is, you know, I've thought about this, and I never really thought about it till I was on that Sunday call. And this, you know, and then getting to know Paul even better, Paul Auster, and reading about, you know, reading his new book, Burning Boy, which was really, you know, wonderful.
Yeah, great biography.
About another New Jersey guy, Stephen Crane.
Yeah.
And so we talked about Miami, but you're a New Jersey guy through and through. So let's talk about New Jersey a little bit. What is it about New Jersey? I mean, we talked a little bit. I know that there are poets that are associated with New Jersey. There's something about New Jersey that a lot of us who don't know New Jersey don't really get.
Well, there are several New Jerseys. There's northern New Jersey and especially northeastern New Jersey, where I'm from. I was born in Teaneck, New Jersey, and grew up in Tenafly. These are towns in Bergen County. This is the northeast lip of the state, and I grew up a stone's throw from the GW Bridge. We could be in Midtown Manhattan in 30 minutes without traffic. So while you have all that intense energy from New York City coming at you, New Jersey, especially northern and northeastern Jersey, is its own culture zone. And it's a dense population, very multicultural. It has produced an extraordinary range of writers. I mean, Stephen Crane, Philip Freneau, if you want to go back to the American Revolution, the first great poet of the nation, Philip Roth, Allen Ginsberg, Amiri Baraka, Robert Pinsky, Allen Ginsberg, I mentioned. William Carlos Williams. The list goes on. It's a rich place of creative and cultural energy. It's also a rich place for popular music.
The Boss, right?
Yeah, Frank Sinatra, the Four Seasons, the Shirelles. We have a lot of Bruce Springsteen. We have a lot of linguistic energy, a lot of music, poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction. Have come out of the Garden State. A lot of people don't think of it as gardeny because they see the industrial northeast, but a lot of the state is beautiful farms and horse farms. And then there's the Jersey Shore, which gives the state its kind of expansive openness. It's an interesting place to have come out of. Manhattan was always just immediate spot for me as soon as I could put keys in the car ignition. I was in New York City. I was down the Village. I was in the East Village.
This was in the mid-60s.
Yeah, it was the late 60s, latter 60s by the time I got a driver's license. But yeah, I started going to the city partying in the mid-60s. So the city was just so exciting then, even if we look back at it now and see that it was a more dangerous and more chaotic place than it is today. Who knew then? Then you just live in the place you live. So I really had a beautiful experience of kind of a suburban culture on the other side of the GW Bridge and access to a rich Manhattan life. My one aunt Anna Balakian was a professor of French literature at NYU, and my other aunt, Nona Balakian, was an editor at the New York Times Book Review. So I have all these Balakian roots in Manhattan. That was all a rich part of my New York City connection. So, but coming back to Jersey, a dynamic place. So another person I comes to mind, and he was he went to the same prep school that I did, was Tony Bourdain, Anthony Bourdain. An original voice, a terrific writer, and a great journalist, beloved of millions in this country. So you can keep adding to that New Jersey culture list, and it comes to be quite rich.
I've developed a brand new appreciation for things New Jersey, because I love all of those people you mentioned, but I never put the New Jersey thread through them all. And I thank you for doing that. Would you read another poem for us?
This is in my new book, in which I have a section of fruit and vegetable meditations or object lessons. And in this poem, Eggplant, a much cooked vegetable, fruit vegetable in Middle Eastern cuisine, in Armenian cuisine, there are evocations of the violent Armenian genocide deportation past, but this poem is going to come out on the dinner table in New Jersey in the end. Eggplant. I loved the white moon circles and the purple halos on a plate as the salt sweat them. The oil in the pan smoked like bad days in the Syrian desert, when a moon stayed all day, when morning was a purple elegy for the last friends seen, when the fog of the riverbank rose like a holy ghost. My mother made those white moons sizzle in some egg wash and salt. Some parsley appeared from the garden, and summer evenings came with no memory but the table with white dishes. Shining aubergine, black-skinned beauty, bitter apple. We used our hands.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful.
I might read another one. A poem I was mentioning to you, my grandmother was the only survivor of her family. Her entire family was massacred by the Turkish killing squads in the first week of August of 1915. Her escape story I've written about in my memoir, Black Dog of Fate. But this is a kind of poem of celebration, a poem about Ellis Island, that great threshold, that crossing ground where so many Americans have come to find a new life, a place of hope. Ellis Island. The tides of Bach Cantata. The beach is the swollen neck of Isaac. The tides a lamentation of white opals. The beach is free, the Coke machine rusted out. Here's everything you'll never need. Hemp cords, curry combs, jade and musk, a porcelain cup blown into the desert, stockings that walked to Syria in 1915. On the rocks, some ewes and rams graze in the outer dark. The manes of the shoreline undo your hair. A sapphire ring is fingerless. The weed and algae are floating like a bed, and the bloodless gulls, whose breaths would stink of all of us if we could kiss them on the beaks, are gnawing on the dead.
Peter, thank you so much for coming to Miami. Thank you so much for being a part of the reading that you were the other night. But also thank you for your friendship, and thank you for all the good work you do. And And thanks for being on The Literary Life this afternoon.
Mitch, thank you for all of it. And I'll come back anytime. And you've been so amazing to be with these days. Thank you.